What is the job you are being hired to do? And don't say CRO, because that's not the answer. What is the job you are being hired to do? I think there's like three of them. Are you being hired to figure it out? Are you being hired to fix it up? Are you being hired to scale it up? Those are three very simple phrases, but they are three very different flavors of a CRO, and that would dictate a very different agenda in your first 6 months.
Welcome to the X Factor, where we visit with proven private equity-backed leaders to unpack a compelling area of value creation to help our listeners gain an edge. X Factor is presented by Private Equity CXO, the world's largest digital community of PE-backed executives. You can find a link to PECXO in the description to start your free membership and unlock exclusive content.
We have a unique episode for you today. My name is Joe Gravino, Vice President of Go-to-Market Search at Falcon, and I am guest hosting X Factor this week. We are excited to get into today's topic on maximizing organic value creation through the hiring and enablement of the CRO function. Super excited to introduce this panel you guys see here today. We have got a bit of a three-headed monster as it relates to private equity go-to-market expertise. I think what each of our panelists have in common is that they're all former VPs of sales CROs who have sat in many of your shoes, but all made the transition to working for private equity firms as operating partners. Collectively, we've got 75 plus years of operating experience represented, a combined 8 tours of duty as either a CRO or a VP of sales in an investor-backed business, and over 35 portfolio companies advised from the private equity operating partner seat. And look, they all bring unique perspectives. Zori Rotenberg from Charles Bank, or he goes by Z, started his career in investment banking before shifting into this crazy world of sales and sales leadership. So he's going to be approaching things with a finance hat on a lot of the time. Paul Stancic at Parker Gale draws on much of his experience as a consultant in Bain's private equity practice. And he's also just a go-to-market content machine on LinkedIn. Go check out his page if you haven't already. There's a ton of great content there. And then lastly, Kevin McShane, he's from HKW. He's a true operator at heart, came up through sales management, also played in the Notre Dame National Championship football team for Lou Holtz. Kevin, I know you're open to sharing leadership lessons from that, including all your years in business. So Zori and Paul, Kevin, welcome guys. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, X Factor, for having us on today's show. Let's get into it. Jumping in, we're going to be covering two main topics today. First, we're going to talk all things CRO hiring, and then we're going to transition into the strategies and tactics on how private equity firms and CROs can form better partnerships together. Before jumping into those topics, I wanted to set the stage. As we all know, the days of private equity firms creating value solely through things like financial reengineering and cost cutting are long gone. Revenue growth is now critical to realizing returns. To that point, what I've observed in private equity is that there's an immense amount of pressure on today's CRO versus 10 years ago, mainly because CROs are now the anchor of the value creation plan. So for the group, help us all understand what you guys are seeing across your portfolios today related to the pressures that CROs are now facing, especially to help educate a lot of the people that are on here that are thinking about making the jump into private equity from VC, public or private. Zoran, I know you're passionate about this topic, so lead us off.
A lot of our CROs, they have extensive experience in growing lower middle market companies, you know, from about, you know, $20 to $100 million. Their focus is very similar to what they had before. So I would say that not much of a difference than what you otherwise see or have seen in the prior years. I think the bigger issue in private equity overarchingly, not relating just to our CROs, but actually to funds, and I think I wanted to set that as a context, is really that there has been a very significant change in the past few years. So as a context for CROs, in the period from roughly 1980 to 2020, 40-year period, there has been a decline in interest rate of roughly like 2,000 basis points. And in the past 18 months, it's been an increase. And interest rates are so high for private equity firms today that it's much harder to boost your return through the typical sort of private equity playbook of using debt and kind of low interest debt to beef up that return. And when it relates to CROs, What that means is that, you know, economic growth due to the environment is potentially slower. Profit margins are eroding. There's thus pressure to increase revenue growth, but capital efficiently, not sort of throwing money at the headcount and the problem. And I think that has a very significant effect on CROs because they're being pressured to do more with less, but very capital efficiently. By the way, the interest rate environment, we're seeing that in the past 18 months, as interest rates are continuously increasing and probably will not be declining anytime soon, is that also the buyers of our portfolio companies may not have sort of the same ability as they did before, raising debt to acquire companies, right? And they expect more. So everything I've said, to summarize, puts a lot more pressure on CROs to deliver more with less and capital efficiently.
Yeah, no doubt. Paul, Kevin, anything else to add?
Yeah, I like that Z went right to the macroeconomic because he's much better armed to cover that topic than I am. But I part of the reason I'm excited for this session today is the three of us all kind of invest in the same zip code, right? These sort of emerging tech companies. And I think part of our job is to help put a plan in place and find the team that's going to finish the work that the founder started. And part of that value creation plan, Z hit on it, is, hey, you can't just cost cut or efficiency your way to a return. You actually have to make the business enduringly better. And in our world of go-to-market, the person that you're looking for to lead that revenue function, whether it's just sales or sales and marketing, you can't just look for the person that's going to help you win the next deal or hit the next quarter. Like, they have to be the person to put a system in place that's going to help you figure out who to call and what to say and how to stand out, and to do that predictably and repeatably and build a foundation that's capital efficient, just like Z said, but that the next buyer of this asset is going to be impressed by and is going to believe in. And so I think that's a different set of requirements and a different type of pressure on the go-to-market organization as a whole than maybe existed 5 or 10 years ago. Some of that's a function of the asset class that we play in, but some of it's a function of the era that we're in. And I think it creates a ton of pressure for the right CRO. But at the same time, the scope of the impact that you can have as a CRO, both in making a business better and also in writing a compelling story for a successful exit, there's never been a more interesting time for that. And there's never been a more interesting time for guys like us who get to partner up with these folks and help them make it happen. So that's the cool thing about, I think, today's conversation. That's the cool thing about our job too.
Yeah, I agree with your point. I think a lot of time we are working with private equity firms on how to spec out the type of CRO that they should hire. We have this conversation all the time. Do you find someone from the domain that has relationships, or do you find a private equity best athlete that can get in and build the machine? Ideally, if you can get both, that's great. But I think where private equity is leaning is the person that can get in there and build the revenue machine, the systems, the processes to make everything repeatable over time.
It's a great question. I think Z really nailed the kind of the macro level issues and challenges. And then Paul comes in and I think spot on really talks about great leaders are building a highly predictable asset that's really attractive down the road. So in our firm, our fund, it's tech exclusive. And the decisions that, you know, selecting whether it's a chief revenue officer or even a CEO in any other chief executive roles, these are the most consequential decisions that will determine the fate of any team, company, and organizations. And Joe knows this. I must admit, I'm pretty fond of a saying that the U.S. Navy SEALs have. And they say there are no bad teams, only bad leaders. And the biggest challenge, I think, in terms of the change for a sales executive, a sales chief, a CRO, is that the scope expectations have dramatically increased and changed for this persona. So in our fund, we ask our leaders, whether it's, again, the CRO or the CEO, to what we call solve a bigger problem. So typically the founder has run the company with this very narrow perspective on what the tech does, what it solves for, and who they sell to. So our expectations and the advice I'd give to an incoming sales executive, sales chief, is think about solving a bigger problem. That's re-examining the product market fit, expanding the ideal customer persona, and then ultimately authoring a new value proposition. Because what we really care about, I know Z would agree, and I know Paula agrees, that year one, we're looking for that sales chief to double, triple the average deal size. We're looking to decrease that sales cycle, increase the conversion rates, winning percentages, and ultimately that year one achieve sales productivity targets. So I think that's the biggest thing that we're asking our CROs and VP sales and sales chiefs is really solve a bigger problem going forward.
I want to chime in also. Totally agree with Paul and Kevin. You mentioned about selecting the right CRO and kind of the CRO characteristics or right fit would be something that comes to mind, like what would make someone a good fit. Knowing that you have an audience of private equity teams and also CROs, I wanted to make a sort of integrated point that for each stage, there are different fit CROs. So for example, and I think, you know, Kevin, Paul, and I are all focused on kind of lower middle market, you know, companies, but we'd say 20 to 100 million in revenue, give or take, right? And that's a different CRO than someone who would come into a company at 300 million or at 5 million. The other thing is that it's very important to discern between what's a VP of sales and what's a CRO. A lot of times there's a CRO title, but it's not actually a CRO role. It's very important, I believe, to zoom in on what it is that you want to achieve. What are the KPIs or goals? Then link that to the responsibilities. Titles aside, a CRO with the right, you know, CRO responsibilities and goals is someone who drives performance for the overall revenue of the business, leads the entire revenue team, and optimizes for the entire revenue lifecycle and growth, which is the KPIs of that are sales bookings that affect recurring revenue or overall GAAP revenue, obviously net retention, and everything in between, you know, pipeline creation, new customer acquisition versus expansion sales into existing customers, leading specific teams. It's really critical to have a person with that right fit. And in private equity, that's someone who has a lot more experience in larger deal sizes as well as middle market, plus not only new logo acquisition or new customer acquisition, but also understanding expansion sale to existing customers. In a world of earlier stage companies, that's very different. Sometimes it's all about new business and that's it. So it's very important to understand the difference between a title and a role. First, understand, sort of start with the end in mind. What goals are you trying to achieve? And if it's the entire revenue, then it's a real CRO role, not just the title. One other point from a macro and PE perspective that I want to throw in is that, as I was saying earlier, the game in private equity is changing a little bit or shifting. And Paul said something important. You can only add so much value through efficiency or cost cutting or optimizing sort of in a financial perspective for the company's capital structure. So today, growing revenue is much more important as a value creation driver than possibly ever before. And revenue affects your margins, your gross margins. That more revenue growth, more sales and revenue growth gives you more cash for private equity companies to pay down their debt and also for add-on acquisitions, which is a big part of private equity motion and strategy. Furthermore, more revenue and more sales increases your EBITDA. That ultimately expands your multiple, that's multiple expansion, and gets you to a much better exit. Revenue growth and go-to-market focus and having great CROs for us in private equity today is the most important number one value creation lever.
That's why we're all here talking about it, Z. So I couldn't agree more. Yeah, I think that's back to your point on CRO versus VP of sales. It's a conversation we have to have with a lot of our clients as well that are buying founder-led businesses. And if you get a $10 million ARR company that has nothing by way of really anything on the sales and marketing front, do you need a CRO who's highly paid? Or is it more, okay, let's get into VP of sales, a VP of marketing who can build out their respective functions, and then from there, hire a CRO on top of that, unless the VP of sales or VP of marketing emerge as the person to lead the full go-to-market. So I definitely agree. There's definitely some nuance there. But shifting gears now into the CRO hiring conversation, we all know revenue growth doesn't happen without having the right CRO on the bus. And when you need to turn over a CRO, it is costly. It's painful for any portfolio company. So I would love to hear from each of you on just how you approach CRO hiring and retention. Both are important. to avoid turnover with your portfolio companies? Paul, start with you.
We're pretty open on our philosophy on hiring. If you Google Parker Gale hiring handbook, the secret sauce is not so secret. It's all out there on the internet. When it comes to CROs or just go-to-market leadership positions in general, I would put VP of sales and CMO in the same bucket. Where I see teams make mistakes, or when they look back at hires that they thought would do great and were not so great, they tend to fall down in the hiring process in a couple different places. One is just starting with knowing what you want. What you want to avoid is saying, we have an empty box in our org chart in the CRO position, we're going to go get one. And then you end up with a CRO from central casting, as I call it. Each of these positions, they all have the same title. If Z and Kevin and I talked about, you know, the hires we have to make in the next few years in our portfolio, they're all going to have the same thing on their business card. They are very different jobs with very different requirements and very different sequences of priorities. So I think most job descriptions absolutely suck. There's a sort of dog's breakfast of all of the things that you might be asked to do and all the requirements that you might have in your past. There are very few people that approach the CRO hiring process with a kind of jobs to be done framework. If we fast forwarded, and I'm hiring Joe as my CRO, welcome to the interview process, Joe. If we fast forwarded 12 months into your tenure, what are the things that the business absolutely needs you to finish or diagnose or figure out for us? That should form the backbone of the job description that you write, and that should form the backbone of the hiring process that you implement to filter out the people that would be a good fit. So I would say start by writing a better job description and start by reflecting future forward of what do you need this person to do? It's a very basic question. Most people never take the time to answer it. And then I think the second thing is, like, I approach hiring in terms of two types of problems. There's funnel problems and there's filter problems. A funnel problem is you want to get as many good fit candidates into your funnel so you can pick the best ones. And the filter problem is you're going to devise some kind of mechanism to pick the winners from the people who aren't such a good fit. And what we found in the last few years is that a combination of a really deep behavioral interview with some kind of show me homework assignment has been much more predictive for us than just say, hey, tell me about a time you did this, walk me through your resume, and, you know, let's get dinner to make sure there's a good fit here. So with that homework assignment, I can't recommend enough, if you can find a way to inject actual materials from what the business is going through and just ask the person for a reaction. What do you think is most important? What stands out? If you were armed with this context in your first week on the job, what would you prioritize first and how would you do that? And by the way, what are some things that you've done in your past that gives us confidence that you can go and do that? Hiring processes, too often it's, let's go in, do a bit of a la-di-da interview, pick the person from central casting. And then you're surprised 6 months later when the thing that you knew deep down needed to be done doesn't get done. It's on you to define the job and then test for the things in that job description. And that is a mistake that is still made way too often in our world, in my opinion.
Agreed. And to your point on the homework assignment, I always recommend that any private equity firm hiring a CRO, more than any other position, does that homework assignment or a case study or a job trial, whatever you want to call it, because sales leaders and CROs are professional salespeople. And the number one product they know the best are themselves.
So, and they will close you if you let them. So don't let them.
Exactly. We're always in the business having them show us and pick the best one from there.
I'll just jump, just because I love kind of Paul's coaching and guidance there. I think it's spot on. I think everybody should really kind of take heed with the roadmap he just kind of laid out. We look for a couple of specific attributes in our leaders. You know, we want our leaders to build great culture. It's exactly what you said, Joe. If it's 10 million in ARR, 20 million, 30 million, they're a little bit more kind of early stage. There's a lot of building to be done. And it really starts with great leaders that can create great culture. Joe knows this. I'm fond of this particular quote that I'll share. On any team, in any organization, all responsibility for success and failure rests with the leader. The leader must own everything and everything in his or her world. There's no one else to blame. The leader must acknowledge mistakes, admit failure, take ownership of the team, and develop a plan to win. It's a quote by Jocko Willink that I really like, and that's part of our interview process, is where did in your career something go really bad, and how'd you handle it? And we're looking for leaders to really take that ownership and say, that's on me. It's my mistake. I'm responsible. And then start to develop a plan on how to get the team, the organization back on track. We want leaders, especially in this kind of small mid-market, Joe, that you're describing, you can't point a finger. Take ownership, develop a plan to win. And I think the second attribute that I'd love to introduce in terms of candidates that we're looking to hire, whether it's the CRO, VP sales, or even the CEO, is what we call building career trajectory inside the teams. When you take over as a leader, you're inheriting a team. You need to make that team work effectively and optimize that. And what we call building career trajectory, that means starting with hiring the entry-level sales roles, the BDR, the SDR, making the right hires there. And then, wow, putting them into sales university, putting them into supporting them, coaching them, hands-on role-playing every day, building that culture in the team. And then within 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, we want those, the BDRs, the SDRs, outbound, inbound reps, we want them to be promoted into a contract renewal specialist, a customer success manager, into a sales AE, national account manager. And during the interview process, Joe, what I'm looking for with candidates that are applying for a VP sales, a CRO, CEO role, is show me, demonstrate with me in your past engagements where you built career trajectory and got people, gave them the tools, the support, and enablement. That's what I'm looking for, because that's the kind of leaders that we want. Because if you have and you demonstrate career trajectory where people are getting the support, the training they need, they're getting promoted, they love the company, they love the team. Now, Joe, we got great culture. People aren't leaving. The turnover is practically zero. There's one quick use case. I started with the team in the portfolio 2 years ago now. It's based in Houston. And when we walked in, they really didn't have a VP sales, but there was one person in particular that was kind of the go-to kind of leader inside the hall. And I started working with him, and he reeked of talent and skill. He just didn't necessarily know it. We put him on a career trajectory. We talked about becoming a team leader. We put him in a program. He was the director of sales in Q2, Q3. He absolutely knocked it out of the park. He enjoyed the management. And then a year later, post-investment, a year later, he was announced as the VP sales. The VP sales of a private equity-backed high-growth tech company down in Texas. Now think about what that does to the morale inside that building. Sky high, because here's one person that the team invested in, and now he's leading the team to great success.
I really like what Paul and Kevin said. So there's not a ton I can add there. First of all, Kevin, I really like how you think about sports. I also think that's one of the best ways to consider for CROs to build out teams is about the culture, because leaders drive the culture and culture drives people's behaviors. Those behaviors actually drive results. Nothing affects execution, especially on the revenue side and in sales, more than the culture. So finding out someone, and by the way, culture is obviously not, you know, ping pong tables or whatever, it's about sort of behaviors that you celebrate and those that you don't tolerate. So understanding how the revenue leader fits into that for any particular portfolio company is critical. So for example, for us as go-to-market operating partners in private equity, we have this unique perspective because we intimately know the portfolio company and its needs. And we can then go out and look for the right CRO and work with a recruiter like yourself, Joe, right? You guys do a lot of this kind of work and do a great job. We have this unique perspective of knowing exactly what the company needs. Then we work to create a scorecard. and specific criteria that really fits this particular company's context. And then we work with a recruiter and find great candidates to be able to find a tier one candidate that is a great leader that proactively creates the right culture for this particular company. Additionally, besides being a great leader and having sort of an effect on the culture, the key things that private equity firms and CROs have to align on is not what is typically considered, which is industry experience. So we're a vertical company in this particular industry. Sure, that's a really nice to have, but I think it's much more complex to obtain sort of sales management and specifically modern sales management, quantitative data-driven sort of sales engineering, sales management expertise that takes a lot longer to perfect as a skill and as a science, not an art, than just having any industry experience. So I just wanted to add some of those points to complement what Paul and Kevin said.
Yeah, that's great. There's a unique dynamic happening in private equity where you've got a record amount of private equity firms fundraising capital. So you got a record amount of dry powder sitting in the sidelines. But on top of that, the number of portfolio companies in the US are growing at 10% per year. The talent pool of people that can actually do this job are growing at only 2% per year. So back to Paul's funnel point, I think one of the things that we always try to do with our private equity firms and deal teams is try to level set to say, okay, here's what the market's giving us. I understand this is what you want for your portfolio company, and shift mid-process to be able to really clearly define what are the key things that you need and where are some of the trade-offs that you may accept given what the market's providing at this time, because there just aren't enough leaders out there given the amount of PE-backed opportunities out there. And then, Paul, we had a good question addressing one of your earlier points. Mainly, it's about how you really coach many of the private equity, either the portfolio company management teams or the boards themselves, on how to run a smooth process, on how to think about how to hire. Because there's obviously, what we see many times, I'm sure you guys do as well, there's a lot of misalignment there. When you get a misalignment from a CEO to you, to the rest of the board, that's when things start to fall apart. When there's alignment across the board, it's great and the searches go really smooth. But how do you guys go about achieving that?
How do you solve that problem full stop is a very difficult question. I don't think I've cracked that. And when you do, let me know, because we'll go start a business and make some money. Look, everybody has perspectives on what they see inside of the business from the management team. And everybody notices some of the problems that are going on and some of the opportunities that are there for the taking. And everybody has a stack ranking of which of those feels most important, like where the big fire is versus the little fire next to the propane tank. Something that works well for us just tactically is pulsing each member of the team, including us, that's involved in the hiring process, and asking really basic questions like, what does this person need to accomplish in their first few months? What do they need to be uniquely great at? Who are they going to have to work with most closely to get it all done? And just literally like spill that Lego box of answers on the table and embrace the fact that they are very different answers from very different members of the team, and say, hey, we don't all have to agree, but we do have to commit to what we're going to put on the page for this job description and what we're going to test for most intensely in the hiring process. So I think rather than getting people to synthetically harmonize on what is most important, everyone's going to have a different take on that. Something that works well is just embrace those different takes, capture them individually, bring them all together, and then use that to create the profile and to create the process. And it doesn't need to be perfect. It just has to be yours. So I don't know. No, everyone's going to have a different take. Embrace that, use it, and then bring everyone together. Because most teams, even if they disagree on, hey, what's most important or the qualifications or where this person should come from or things like, is experience more important in the industry or is SaaS experience more important? People just want to be heard. And if you give people a chance to be heard and then bring those perspectives together, one, people will like to weigh in before they buy in on anything. And two, you'll surface some other problems that, you know, as the executive search firm or the operating partner, or whoever it is, you probably didn't even have an appreciation for going into the process.
I think Paul's bringing up a really good, great framework I think we could all learn from. I think, you know, Joe, from our perspective, again, we're in that 20 to 30 million or under ARR. You know, we're looking for part of the interview process, whether it's a CEO candidate, CRO candidate, VP, sales, marketing. We're looking for people that want to get their hands dirty. A lot of these companies, there is no HR, there's no sales operate. And that typically can be a downside, a disadvantage to one candidate. Maybe they're used to having all this infrastructure and support. So that for us is a really important, are they used to kind of building something from scratch, right? Are they hands-on? Can they build culture from the ground up? And then, as I talked about earlier, can they solve a bigger business problem with the product and expand into new markets, expand into different personas, and grow average deal size? So that for us is really important, is somebody who really wants to be hands-on, that has that great experience and really gets energy, the passion from kind of building something from scratch versus inheriting and managing something.
I'll just double tap that. Where we get head faked and the times that we've missed historically, we've fallen victim to that. We're giving people credit for more dirty work than they're actually willing to do. And so the lesson we've learned from that is to really ask for the context around those stories in a behavioral interview. So not only what you were you able to accomplish and not only what were the results, who was helping you, how big was your team, how many resources did you have, what was the time frame, what were the expectations? Because someone might tell a great story about increasing win rates or revenue or ASP or gross margin, like whatever matters. But if they had a team of 40 underneath them and all they had to do was sit on top and be the figurehead, that is not going to be the situation in any company that Z and Kevin and I are involved in. Altitude control is something that I prioritize in an interview a ton. Can you stay up here and notice from 30,000 feet the problems that need solving and what matters most? But can you literally dive down at 5 feet and help the team get the work done? A lot of executives are good at 30,000 feet, but they're not used to flying at such a low altitude. And we need that inside of our companies.
Kevin and Paul really did a great job of answering that. Look, when we hire CROs, all three of us, right? We help our portfolio companies. We're there as former CROs, and we really understand what a great tier one CRO looks like, combined jointly with what this portfolio company needs based on our sort of much more intimate knowledge of the company. But in order to sort of mitigate risk and ensure there's no sort of failure later after we hire, and by the way, I do think that we help hire effectively. And none of these CROs, or nobody frankly, wakes up any day and wants to fail. So everybody works hard and does their best. But what we also do on our side as go-to-market operating partners is maintaining consistent contact and touch points. Sometimes I have calls that our CROs ask me to do weekly with them. I don't force them to that, right? But we go through their priorities and we serve as sounding boards to our CROs to ensure that the alignment and the execution is done effectively all throughout the whole period or the ownership of the portfolio company. So there's much more that happens after we recruit the CRO. The other point sort of related to this I was going to make is that what I think is great in private equity, especially with the three of us and some of the other firms that do have an operating partner who specifically focuses on go-to-market, is that going to board meetings and being consistently involved with portfolio companies adds like a 10x sort of force multiplier on helping the CROs and go-to-market teams be successful. So for example, like random example, but you know, Snowflake, the CRO there, he said he joined the company, and Snowflake is a high growth tech company. And he said nobody on the board had a go-to-market or CRO experience. And he said, frankly, I'm not that interested in this opportunity as a CRO because there's nobody who cares about me, the CRO, or about sales. So they went out and a few days later brought John McMahon, who's a very famous legendary CRO. He wrote the book. And it's a great example of having a board member, somebody at the board, like the three of us, who consistently think and live and breathe how to optimize the CRO's job, how to amplify the CRO, and how to help the CRO be successful. To summarize that point is, we focus a lot on recruiting with firms like you with Falcon, for example, and you do a great job. You always help recruit a great candidate and put him in the right, put the right person in the right seat or in the right bus. But after that, it begins the next process over the next 3 to 5 years of ensuring that that CRO is successful.
Joe, Z's exactly right. If I'm a candidate for a CRO position or even a CEO position in a portfolio company, Z's exactly right. What I'm interested in is learning what's the support structure that I'll have in terms of whether it's the operating partner representing the portfolio, maybe it's the board members. I think Z's exactly right, that support structure, because good leaders are coachable. That's, to us, the number one attribute, whether it's the chief revenue officer, the CEO, or the sales AE, we want people who are coachable. And that to us is really probably one of the most important attributes. And to Z's point, if there's a CRO candidate and he or she is asking about the support structure that they will have in terms of coaching and developing, that would be really important for us and a good indicator that's the right person who's going to be open to coaching during his or her tenure at the helm.
Yeah, and it pays the test for that. Kevin, I couldn't agree more. I've totally started prioritizing that quality, call it coachability or whatever you want to call it, way more in interviews, you know, this year versus a few years ago. Lack of self-awareness is poison, and the antidote is reflection and review. I want to know that people are not only open to that, but that they have a process and a habit and almost like a ritual around getting feedback, knowing what their blind spots are, and accepting help from the outside.
Paul, one of the leading attributes for the portcos who are overperforming is that leadership team is highly, highly coachable.
Amen. Yep. We see the same thing.
Yeah. And something that we focus on in all of our interview processes too. You have to know your audience. You're working with private equity. Most private equity firms in today's day and age that also hire someone like yourselves as an operating partner focused on go-to-market, you have to be open. You have to have the low ego, the self-esteem to say, you know what, I've done this before, but I understand that I'm doing it in a portfolio that likes to do things a certain way. I've got a great resource that wants to help me, and I'm vulnerable enough to accept the help and then just try to execute your way around all of that. Yeah, I think anyone that loves the hands-off private equity firm that checks in quarterly, maybe if that, I think the days of that are long gone.
It's one of the sort of challenges of a role of being an operating partner in a private equity firm. You're not supposed to actually push or tell your portfolio executives what to do, right? Because they don't actually like that. Plus, there's less accountability if you do that. So there's a bit of an art to being pulled in and being a coach. And Kevin and Paul really know how difficult that is, being a coach, but not by actually telling, but sort of understanding and listening. And then being a sounding board, just like board of directors, but without really forcing them to do anything specific, but kind of gently guiding them in the right direction to explore. For example, the other day we had a call with one of our portfolio companies, and we were looking at, you know, diagnosing some of the items happening in Q3 and Q4. Is it the win rate? Is it the decline in the average deal sizes? Is it a pipeline inflow that's been declining and not increasing per rep, sort of commensurately as we increase sales reps? Or is the sales cycle extending because the pipeline mix was many larger deals versus smaller deals, and the larger deals almost necessarily have longer sales cycles? And you cannot actually point out and say, you did this or that, and you should have done this or that, right? So that's the challenge of the role. So for the CROs out there, you also want to go to, I think, private equity firms that have folks like Paul and Kevin, myself perhaps, who are not really pushing you, that are much more partners and collaborative, working together with you. That's what coaching really truly is. And they're serving as your sounding board between the investment teams and the portfolio company. And that's rare. Never mind the fact that it's also rare in private equity to have an operating partner exclusively focused on go-to-market. I think, Joe, you may know this better than me, but that's kind of a new thing.
Yeah, it's definitely a newer role in private equity over the last 5 years. It's very similar to the head of human capital, the head of talent role 10 years ago, where every private equity firm started to figure out, hiring matters and building leadership teams lead to growth at portfolio companies. Let's hire someone like that. Now revenue growth is the new number one value creation lever, as we all talked about. So you're going to start to see a shift of a lot of private equity firms bringing in people like yourselves who are former CROs who can now work with portfolio companies to make sure that, you know, there's good discipline on the go-to-market side. I think a lot of private equity firms are still figuring out how to spec that out, how to hire once they hire, how to use that person best effectively, whether it's at one portfolio company or all their portfolio companies. So it'll depend and the role will shape, how it's shaped over the next 10, 15 years. But yeah, it's definitely a newer role. There's probably only 50 private equity firms out there that I at least know of that have the role. And then just to help out our CROs in the audience, when a CRO is interviewing for a PE-backed role, what are some of the questions they should be asking in diligence? And then also, what are some of the red flags that when they hear these or start to pick up on these, they should start to run for the hills and not pursue that CRO role? Kevin, why don't you kick us off?
Sure. I think the basics, and I'd imagine Paul and Z kind of have the same, you know, I think the basics would be, what's the original investment thesis? That's an easy one. What's the exit timeline? What's the hold period? Is it 3? Is it 5 years? Is it 7? If I were a candidate interviewing with the team for a CRO role, really where I dig in is, what are the challenges facing the organization? What are the market challenges, the competition, product? When you look at the growth rate, deal size, all the metrics, sales productivity, what are the challenges? Because what I would want to do is go in eyes wide open day one, knowing the challenges. I don't want to be surprised. We're looking for great leaders that, yep, there's some macro headwinds, there's some micro, right? You know, not everything's perfect. We want leaders to go that are going in eyes wide open, but want to embrace the challenge. Hey, this is a company, it's slow growth. It goes into this market sector. And hey, it's 10 million in ARR. We want it to be 30 million in ARR. We're looking for leaders that want that challenge. And the ones that are kind of cautious and, oh my gosh, you know, these are the headwinds, macro level, that's not going to be a great fit. We're looking for leaders who are just by default aggressive and want to take on that challenge.
Yeah, what we always look for is this concept of disdain for losing. They just hate losing in the market. They have to constantly look around them, learn from all the losses, right, constantly figure out where in the business that needs improving, and then go fix it. That's the beauty of private equity, is just finding what needs to be fixed and then prioritizing how to go out and fix it. That's how value creation happens. So yeah, we love CROs and sales leaders that are wired like that.
So to the point of, you know, this question of what should CROs be asking of private equity firms as they're being hired, right? Yeah, so I would say, you know, totally agree with Kevin. I would say it's very important to have good chemistry with the board and folks who are at the private equity firm who'll be working with you, not just the CEO for whom you're working at the company or the team that's on the executive team with whom you have to be aligned. It's very important to get to know everyone, right? So I've helped recruit a couple of CROs and various VPs and go-to-market team members at various portfolio companies in the past year alone, was helping also recruit one of the CEOs who's very commercially minded. And it's very important to know those who are asking more about you and about the board and trying to understand what will be sort of the outcome working together for them, right? Because ultimately you could be really successful, very experienced, but if you don't align really well, personally and professionally, that's a real risk.
Yeah, we're kind of talking about what going into the hiring process, how do you sniff around and figure out a combination of like what they're looking for and how your skills line up, right? I'm on a bit of a jobs to be done kick and I've had a lot of caffeine, so I'll go back to that framework. What is the job you are being hired to do? And don't say CRO, because that's not the answer. What is the job you are being hired to do? I think there's like three of them. There are probably more, but are you being hired to figure it out? Are you being hired to fix it up? Are you being hired to scale it up? Those are three very simple phrases, but they are three very different flavors of a CRO. And that would dictate a very different agenda in your first 6 months. So one of the things that I coach people to do, and this is not backfired yet, but I can't make a perfect promise, is if you're going into a job, a CRO interview, I think you should rewrite the job description and show it to them and say something like, I've done a little research on you guys, where you are at in terms of your age and stage and just what the business does. I've picked up some context from conversations with the leadership team. I actually think this is what you're looking for. How did I do? And all I know is that I'm wrong, right? I have never had that for people who've taken that advice and done it. I've never had it backfire. It's always led to a really interesting conversation. And about 75% of the time, the hiring team will come back and say, this is actually way better than what we put together. So thank you. So you've just flipped the interview process on your head. But like that idea of asking the questions and doing the homework that you need to do to figure it out. If it is a figure it out CRO job, you are coming in, maybe it's founder-led sales until this point, and you need to establish a go-to-market motion. So you need to create a hypothesis about how you're going to go find your next 100 customers and build that from scratch. That's very different from a fix-it-up situation where maybe you have a team of 10 sellers. We kind of know that half of them aren't going to make it, and we kind of think that we might not have the right ICP, but there's some goodness there that we want to build on versus scale it up. Like, hey, we've gotten from 10 to 30 in ARR. It's going really fast. It's a little bit uncomfortably fast in terms of the growth. And we need to build some infrastructure to make sure this thing doesn't break as we add 10 million more in ARR over the next few years. Asking about the setup, I think, is a step that people tend to miss in the hiring process. And especially for a senior leadership position, like you're taking a bet on a good chunk of your career with this position. You have complete permission to ask those questions about what's actually going on. And if you had to put it in one of these three buckets, which one is it? And then the second piece is, what are the red flags? I've written a little bit on how to make a career decision. I think it comes down to purpose, mastery, and autonomy. Are you going to be on a journey that means something to you? Can you get better at something that, you know, that's important to you? And are you going to have a chance to have some agency in that journey? Can you figure out that the boat should go this way instead of the other way? That's a good thing to ask about. Is there a plan you can beat? I think the good news is we're kind of past this age, at least in our world, of like, hey, yeah, we're going to grow 100% year over year, and we'll figure out how to make that happen. But ask about the budget. Ask about what is the number that you're supposed to meet in your first 2 years? How many reps do you have? How many resources do you have? What's already working? And how much of an inflection point are you being hired to create? Because you're not looking for something easy, but you are looking for something achievable. And again, you have complete permission to ask questions about what type of situation you're stepping into and what type of inflection you're being hired to go catalyze. A lot of people skip that step, and I think that's a mistake.
Joe, I'd be willing to wager, I think all these candidates going forward will be rewriting the job description in the interview process.
Joe and the team do a good job of making it clear. There's a lot of people that go out there and look for people, and it's just, again, it's a little bit of a patchwork quilt of requirements. It hasn't backfired yet. You can call me if it backfires, but if you present it in the right way and if you do it with humility, like, hey, all I know is this is wrong, but I'm taking what you guys have fed me and I'm feeding it back to you. Because I think aligning on what you want me to do, where we're going to go, how we're going to get there, and what it's going to take, that alignment's super important to me. So how did I do? There's very few teams that would take that presentation of a rewritten job description and say, like, forget this guy, right? So it's the what, but it's also the how in that exercise.
Right. Love it. I think that's a million-dollar piece of advice, Paul.
Yeah, it goes
I'll
back
send
to
you an invoice.
Well, we've got 5 minutes left, and one last thing I really want to cover with you three, because I think it's highly important, is that once a CRO is hired and they're in the seat, it's a very difficult role to be able to impact the business quickly in the first 100 days, 6 months, year, especially when you're walking into something that you are trying to gain as much education for the interview process on. What's one simple tactical thing that each CRO can do to get off to a good start with their management team, build trust with the private equity board, and improve the business?
I'll chime in quickly. You're right. It's hard to make a significant impact in the initial stages. First 100 days, like a president, you could say 30, 60, 90. But First 100 days, just build trust, listen, right? Don't try to make too many changes or decisions, right? Because you really, even if you're really good and experienced, you may not know everything that's really happening. Just there are a bunch of small wins. Just take on those small wins in the first 100 days. But I would also say that one of the things that I found always to have the most kind of impact after building trust with the team is kind of trying to affect people on the sales team in a positive way before you judge them, right? Just like observe and, you know, try to build a more positive culture. That's what great leaders do, right? I know Kevin will appreciate this. Bill Walsh, I had this phrase that, you know, the best coaches lay awake at night thinking how to make people better. So how do you make people better? How do you become like this servant leader with low hanging fruits? And that team will actually go out of their way to be much more positively sort of responsive to that kind of a leader. And then the last thing, you didn't mention compensation questions of CROs and private equity, et cetera, which is great. But I would say that if you do have a chance, people on the sales team or go-to-market or in general, the revenue team, people will look for a new leader to fix their compensation issues. That's almost like always the case. And if you can help people there, if there is a budget, that's one of the things people truly appreciate. I always give advice that not everyone takes it, but try to pay people just a little bit more than the market if you can, or a little bit more or more than the market rate. People really appreciate it. It's a small, you know, it's short dollars, right? Everybody tries to pay less than the market or at market. Well, be differentiated, pay a little bit more. But the ROI of those dollars is like a step function. It's 10x. People really appreciate it and remember that.
Joe, I'll just quickly go because I know we're short on time. I love how Z's talking about early wins. Couldn't agree more. I'm sure Paul, you know, is behind that 100%. But on the, you know, when I hear how do you build trust with the board, I get a little cautionary, honestly. Trust is earned. You know, trust is earned by delivering on the numbers and the results. And so during these board prep meetings, I really do counsel the leadership team of the portfolio company. Don't oversell in the board meeting. The investors will see right through it. Rather, present like, you know, hey, guys, here's what's working, but here's what's not working. You know, boy, if the leadership team of the portfolio company can walk into the board meeting and check their ego and describe the challenges that they're having and engage the board members for advice and counsel. The best board meetings I've been a part of is where that CEO, the CRO, the CFO come in as a leadership team and really want to engage the board on kind of where we go from here. Here are the challenges. Here are the headwinds. That's when the board members, the investors get energized. And now you're bringing them in to feel like, hey, they're part of the team. So to me, those are the things that really build long-term trust with your stakeholders, the investors, and the board.
Yeah,
I totally agree. And selfishly, I sit in a lot of board meetings. It's probably 10% of my life in this job. And problem solving in a board meeting is way more fun than a status update. And it makes the business better. I truly believe that. So if you can get to a point where you are sort of saying, here's everything that's going on. I want to zoom in here because this is what needs fixing. Here's what we're thinking. Help us make that answer better. That is like fresh bread to me. And it's way better than sitting in a 4-hour PowerPoint death march, right? Get off to a good start with your management team. My coaching is get curious before you criticize. So if you're new in a job, you're going to see all kinds of things. We hired you for your managerial palette. You're going to notice a bunch of problems. Understand the root cause of those problems, how consistent they are, and just get a sense of what's going on before you start to be critical. There's going to be plenty of opportunities to be critical, but get curious before you criticize is my management team trust building one. With the board, Dave Kellogg is a big mentor of mine. He's kind of a giant in the world of software and SaaS. He's done a lot of content recently. His kind of catchphrase these days is templates build trust. So with the board, the quicker you can get into a rhythm where you're showing us the answers to the same questions in the same format again and again, that saves us from having to stare at the board slides like they're a magic eye poster to get the answer to pop out at us. And it gets us into a position where we can just talk about the things that are off, the things that needs fixing, the things that we should double down on. So think templates build trust. We should be showing people the same things 80% of the time, every single time you get together. And then for improving the business, like, especially in our world, I think that the best business thinker on the stuff that we invest in, the stuff that we work on, Dolly Parton, she said, you should figure out who you are and then do it on purpose. In your first 60 days, you should be focused on replicating the success that's already there. So if you can build one sales play with like a list and weapons and a plan of attack and launch that and just replicate the success that was already there in the business before you got there, operating partner, the board, your management team, they're going to fall in love with you. And that's kind of your job in the first couple months. Like, get stuck in, make your team fall in love with you, replicate the success that's already happening. If you do that, you're off to a great start.
Love it. And I think a lot of people are going to benefit from the simplicity of it, because there's a lot of complexity in this job, and simplifying things down to actionable items that are easily executed on are the end of the game. So awesome.
For all the CROs who are under the gun, to Paul's point of criticizing, attack the problem, not the people. It's a stressful job, but do it right.
Awesome. Well, appreciate you three for giving an incredible amount of insight. I think everybody here got a lot out of it. For everyone in the audience, feel free to follow up with any of us if you have any follow-up questions. And once again, thank you guys for your time today.
Great. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you for having us. Good seeing you guys.
Paul, thanks, Z.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Please tune in for our next episode with a panel of guests to discuss defining a path forward for executive women in private equity. This is guest host Joe Gravino, and thank you for listening to X Factor.